May it please the Court, this appeal is from the District Court's findings that the terms ascertain an apparent signature in the continuation patents and transactional operator in Claim 15 of the 625 patent are indefinite.
Can I just ask you a threshold question which maps on to the case we just heard, which is how we define the term validating document and how we view the claim construction issues presented in the first appeal, does that affect at all what we do with the apparent signature being indefinite or non-indefinite?
I don't believe...
Is there any relationship between what we were just talking about before in terms of the continuation claims?
The relationship between them is that in the claims of the 600 and the 948 patent, validating of the document is done by doing two or three things, depending on how you want to count them. One is to review the image of the courtesy amount and review the image of the legal amount on the document. And then secondly, to ascertain an apparent signature, all that done to validate the document. So the validation of a document, which we believe is defined in the continuation patent as determining that the document meets with the bank's requirements, is done through the process of reviewing courtesy amount, legal amount, and ascertaining an apparent signature. Now, ascertaining an apparent signature in the continuations is done by a processor in the ATM. So in the 948 patent, a processor is configured to ascertain an apparent signature in order to validate the document. Now, looking at the specification for some guidance on what it means to ascertain an apparent signature, as the court noted in the last appeal, there is disclosure in the specification that one method of validating a signature is determining that there is a signature present in the document to an acceptable...
We're not validating a signature, right? We're authenticating an apparent signature, right?
That's correct. But the terms validating in this patent are used in different ways. And a method of ascertaining an apparent signature is a way of validating the presence of a signature. That is the corresponding disclosure in the patent. So ascertaining an apparent signature is determining to a level of accepted level of certainty that there is present in the check a signature. So it determines the presence of the signature in a check to an acceptable level of certainty, to an acceptable confidence level. That's the disclosure in the specification that corresponds to ascertaining an apparent signature. That is one of the validation steps that is disclosed in the patent for validating the document, where validating the document involves...
What is the column and line number specifically that you're referring us to right now?
So firstly, we're in the abstract, where it says validation of the document involves one or more of validating the presence of a signature. And then later on in the patent, at column 2, this is a 600 patent now, column 2, lines 14 through 16, column 2, line beginning at line 9, another significant document validation procedure with respect to checks is determination that a signature is present. That is, the check is signed at the signature line. And then it goes on, going even further, it would be helpful to establish some acceptable signature confidence level by a comparison of the signature against a stored signature.
Well, isn't that part of the problem there is with regard to indefiniteness? That, I mean, what is an acceptable level of confidence that a signature is present? You wouldn't say that's a subjective determination, right?
No.
You claim that it's an objective determination.
It is, because looking at any accused product, for example, one of ordinary skill in the art would understand what the acceptable confidence level is with respect to finding a signature or doing any of the other validation operations, because a bank will actually set those parameters. Those are parameters that are known and they're described in the patent elsewhere as thresholds that are set by a bank ahead of time. And so a bank, for example, a bank that is validating the presence of a signature on a check will have an algorithm to find the presence of a signature, and then it will associate with that some level of confidence as to whether the signature is there. And if the confidence level exceeds...
What are the parameters? I mean, this is not, if you sign XXX, is that, I mean, you're requiring a cursive sort of signature?
No.
There's a wide range in terms of signatures. Half the people I know just sign with a little mark, and that constitutes their signature. So I'm having a hard time seeing what will fulfill the acceptable level of confidence.
The acceptable level of confidence is part of the process that the computer and the processor use to determine whether there's a signature present. That is beyond the scope of what the claim covers. The claim is not covering the specific procedure whereby a bank will determine whether the signature is present. The claim only requires that as long as the bank is in fact attempting to determine whether a signature is present, then the bank meets the claim. The specific process that the bank uses to determine whether there is a signature present is not claimed. That's not required by the claim. So as long as the bank actually has a process in place in its ATM to determine the presence of a signature, it meets the claim. The claim is not required to answer every question about how to enable it or, you know, what's happened here is that the arguments that that have come in opposition here by the appellee involve looking at what details are not present in the claim. How do we determine what a signature is? Can a block be a signature? The answer is the bank sets its parameters, and as long as the bank is applying whatever those parameters are to determine whether there's a signature present on the check, then the bank meets the claim.
Go on to the next indefiniteness.
I wanted to address one more issue on the issue of an apparent signature. NCR has done is that rather than construe the entire term ascertaining an apparent signature, which we believe means that the processor will determine the presence of a signature to an acceptable level of certainty, they've decided instead to focus on the word apparent signature as if that is a claim term, as if an apparent signature is a type of signature, and then raise issues about what it means to be apparent. The fact is that an apparent signature in isolation is not a term to be construed. It's to be construed in the context of the entirety of the term. And in that case, an apparent signature doesn't identify some undefined type of signature. What it does, the apparent in that claim term identifies the fact that the bank is not going to be able to determine 100% whether a certain mark is a signature.
So you're saying what's covered within that element is anything that any bank does to satisfy itself that there's a signature on the line.
That is correct.
So that could be from some bank which says, well, if I see a dot on the signature line, that's sufficient, to the bank that says that no, we have a much more sophisticated exam.
That's correct.
So you've not detailed anything in the claims in terms of a public notice function for what's covered there other than anything a bank does satisfies this, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a broad claim. I'm not saying that that is not broad. If a bank wants to bother to validate a signature field to find just a dot and say that's a signature, that would be a very strange thing.
So you're claiming the result. You're saying this claim encompasses anything that any bank does to get to a particular result is infringing on this claim, right?
Well, that might be a little broader than what I intend. I intend to say that as long as the processor, like in the 948 patent, is configured to determine whether the check is signed, then it meets the claim. However it does that, whatever technology, whatever standard it wants to use for a signature, whether it has to be typewritten.
So anything that gets to a conclusion that is satisfies them, not satisfies any objective standard, but satisfies any individual user or bank, that would infringe the claim.
Well, it's not subjective to the
extent... You're claiming kind of a result. I don't know if result is the right term, but you're saying any bank that does anything to satisfy itself, whether it's essentially nothing and they just say, we're not going to care about this, we're just going to mark it as done, versus somebody who has this very sophisticated system, they're all infringing on this claim, on this limitation.
They're infringing, but it's not a subjective standard of infringement.
Why did you say yes to that? Your claim says the processor has to be configured to review the images, so it's not any bank doing anything. It's any bank having a computer system with a processor that is comparing the image. Now, the nature of the comparison doesn't have to be finely tuned to fall within the scope of your claim, but it does have to determine yes or no there is a signature here.
That's right. That's why this is not subjective. That you have a processor. It's been programmed to look at an image of a check, and as long as it does look at the image of a check and return whether or not the signature is present, it infringes. That's objective. That's an objective standard. One can discover by looking at any ATM, its documentation, its source code, whatever, that it does in fact ascertain an apparent signature as required by the claim.
Why don't you move on to the second indefiniteness question?
The issue of transactional operator, that is found in claim 15 of the 625 patent. The transactional operator simply refers to a computer that a person can use at an ATM in order to conduct a transaction.
Does it include the buttons that are on the ATM machine itself?
Yeah, well, yes.
Does it include the display screen?
No, it includes the buttons and it includes the computer and the processor and the software that's running on the ATM.
The fact that it took you that long to answer the question sort of suggests, doesn't it, the ambiguity in the term and precisely what the specification discloses that it covers.
Looking at the specification at Appendix 139, and specifically at column 8, lines 43 through 56, there is an embodiment here of a computer that's operated by a user to perform a transaction. It includes a keyboard, it includes a computer, a processor, relevant software, etc. So that's an example in the specification of a computer that's used by a user in order to perform a transaction. Now,
how do you know that the transactional operator corresponds to what's disclosed in columns 9 and 10 here? I mean, there's the word transactional operator isn't a word that's commonly used, right?
That's correct. We have looked at the entirety of the claim term, a transactional operator for operation by the user to perform a transaction. And then we've gone to the specification to see whether the inventor provided any guidance as to, how it would define the transactional operator, what it is that is disclosed in the ATM that corresponds to it.
Right, and why do you think columns 9 and 10 do that?
Because it provides the keyboard for the user to operate. It's a transactional operator, so it includes a keyboard, and then includes the logic behind the keyboard, the computer itself, which allows the user to then cause transactions to be completed, to be executed by the ATM. So it fulfills the requirements for a transactional operator.
When I looked at the claim construction that you proposed to the district court, I didn't see anything about the buttons in there. You just said it sounded as if you were arguing that it was the processor alone.
I know that the construction that we offered was of a computer. I don't I must admit I don't recall the specifics of what the argument was before the district court orally. But it's our point of view that while transactional operator is not a commonly used term, that at least the patentee has provided enough information regarding this computer to indicate that it is in fact the computer in the process in the ATM, including the keyboard that allows, that fulfills, and that is sufficient disclosure of the transactional operator to avoid an indefiniteness problem.
Okay, you're beyond, you've used up most of the rebuttal. We'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal. Let's hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll begin with the ascertaining apparent signature. The word apparent means that infringing ATMs must not only identify actual signatures, but the ATMs must also be capable of identifying, as CAPSIC puts it, marks that appear to be a signature. There's no dispute on this point. And the problem is there's no objective measure anywhere in the patent as to what makes a signature appear to be a signature. CAPSIC agrees. At page 19 of their brief and just now in argument, they said that's not part of the claim. But that's an essential part of the claim because there's no way to have objective scope of the claim term ascertaining an apparent signature unless there's an objective boundary as to what it means to ascertain an apparent signature. So the problem here is one of public notice. There is no way for an ATM manufacturer to know what ATMs do or are or are not capable of infringing the claim until you know what a third party, banks, have made the determination as to what their acceptable confidence level or acceptable parameters are. So just to use an example, going back to the earlier discussion, if an ATM manufacturer makes an ATM that has the technological capability of distinguishing whether or not there is a dot but no more on the signature line, whether or not that infringes can't be determined from the four corners of the patent. It can only be determined if you go around in a survey a bank as to whether or not there being a dot on the signature line qualifies to that bank, in their view, as being an apparent signature. Another bank that might have a much higher threshold, saying that a signature is only one where you can have recognizable characters with certain characteristics like capital letters and multiple words as a signature.
Why does the specification have to disclose all of those various embodiments? If one of ordinary skill in the art would look at the specification and understand that there's many different ways that somebody could do this.
Well, Your Honor, because for a machine to infringe, the machine has to be capable of ascertaining an apparent signature. The question is, what does it mean to ascertain an apparent signature?
What if it includes that wide gamut running, you know, it could be anywhere from a dot to verifying that this signature is the one that's on file at the bank. Then isn't it just a broad claim?
Well, no, Your Honor, because you don't know the scope of the claim until you know the decision making.
You don't know the scope of the claim, even though it covers anything from a dot to verifying that the signature is one that's on file at the bank?
There's nothing in the scope of the claim that says it goes from the dot to one that's on file with the bank. Instead, and CAPSEC's very clear, page 19.
Okay, assuming just for a minute. This is my hypothetical. Assuming the specification supported that interpretation, is there anything wrong with that interpretation? Is it in any way indefinite?
So we don't think that does, but even assuming that it does, that still would be indefinite because that would just be like the situation that the court addressed in the In Re Walter case where there was a claim term of block-like. And the court said, well, we know that a block-like term it includes things that are actual blocks, but it also includes things that aren't actual blocks that appear to be blocks. And so there's a spectrum. There's from something that's obviously not a block to something that is obviously a block. And the court said using the term a block-like doesn't provide enough definiteness because you don't know where on the spectrum all of a sudden the device begins to infringe when something is not a block but sufficiently like a block to become block-like and thus trigger infringement wasn't provided in the context of the patent. There has to be, when you're talking a term of degree.
So what is the question that needs to be answered? What kind of technology a particular bank uses to ascertain it, or what result the bank is seeking to satisfy itself that this is an apparent signature?
I think it may well be both, Your Honor, but it's certainly the latter. Because in order to have a definite bounds on what it means to be appear to be a signature. One who is trying to understand what the patent covers must know what kind of technology has the capability of ascertaining what is apparent signature or not. So there has to be a way to know whether or not a dot on the check is going to be deemed an apparent signature or not. And there's no way looking at the patent to make that determination. And again, CAPSEC agrees with this. CAPSEC says...
Yeah, maybe that goes to enablement or written description, but I don't see how that goes to indefiniteness.
I think, again, you know, it's just like the court in Ray Walters, in Datamize, and all these other cases where the court says you can't have a subjective determination by a third party that then bears on claim scope. And that's exactly what would happen here, because if no bank says the dot is ascertaining an apparent signature, then a machine that can identify a dot but nothing else doesn't infringe. You can't answer the infringement question until you know what a third-party bank has made the subjective determination as to what the requirements are or what they think an apparent signature is. What this claim language is, as CAPSEC has interpreted, is it is an apparent signature to a bank or as it appears to a bank. And there's no guidance in the claim that puts boundaries as to what a bank might determine an apparent signature to be. So again, this is consistent with Datamize and interval licensing, where the court says we can't turn over claim scope to third-party determinations. And it's entirely consistent with the courts that look to terms of degree that say when we're on a spectrum, when we're looking at something that is not 100% but not 0%, there has to be, for the public notice function, a fence put around what is actually within the claim scope and what's without the claim scope, and that's just not done here. And again, CAPSEC doesn't see it differently. They agree that you can't figure out claim scope until you figure out what a bank has determined their acceptable confidence level or their parameters are. Because if no bank, as I said, thinks the dot is a signature, a machine that can identify the dot doesn't infringe. There's additionally no extrinsic evidence anywhere that suggests that there's any kind of objective standard. And as we said, I think this is the exact same problem that the court dealt with in Datamize, in interval licensing, and the same problem the courts looked at in Ray Walter. And I think all of those cases show quite clearly why the public notice function here is just not done. And as I opened the example with, one who sets out to make an ATM just won't know which ATMs do and don't infringe until they know what a decision a bank has made. And the decision a bank makes could change at some point in the future. So it just fails the public notice function. I'll turn to the transactional operator. The term transactional operator, as we described in the brief, you know, as we understand it, there can only be three ways to provide transactional operator definite structure. One would be if using the traditional tools, transactional operator either had a plain meaning or there's intrinsic or extrinsic evidence that bared on it, or if the function required or mandated particular kinds of structure, or if there was a means plus function analysis, which CAPSEC has disclaimed in the reply brief, and we'll accept them at their word on that. But as to the first, there's nothing in the plain language of transactional operator that provides any structure. There's nothing in the intrinsic record. The words transactional operator is not used anywhere. The word operator is used by itself, but it refers to an individual, which is not their construction of this term, and there's just no intrinsic evidence. In terms of the recited function, there's nothing about the function that defines anything that would require a particular structure. And to the court's earlier question as to how CAPSEC can go about picking which of the hardware is qualifies as the transactional operator and which doesn't, we think that the goods dispensing transaction is a particularly good example. So at column 21 of the specification, for example, the patent describes the purchasing lottery tickets or stamps using a machine. And the various hardware it recites to make these purchases includes a general purpose computer. It also includes the keypad buttons, the display screens, as well as a goods dispenser unit. And the goods dispenser unit has certain security controls. The patent identifies the Asahi Seiko USA model CD1000 as a potential goods dispenser unit. But there's no basis that CAPSEC has offered as to why the general purpose computer is in for the transactional operator, but the goods dispenser unit is out. And it would seem that the goods dispenser unit is just as important as the general purpose computer. There's no way to know what qualifies as the transactional operator, and CAPSEC's taking the position that it's not in this other hardware. It's only general purpose computer. And that's why
when I looked at the specification, I was thinking that perhaps the keypads 26 and 27 were the transactional operator because they're described in the specification as operating the transaction options. I mean, how do you respond to that, other than the fact that that's not what seems to have been argued by the patent?
Your Honor, I think that could be a construction. That's sensible, but that's not what CAPSEC has pointed to as the transactional operator. They think it's the computer, and this is exactly Dr. Chatterjee's analysis. You can look at the keypad, you could look at the computer, you could look at the goods dispenser, and you don't know which of these it is. And that's where the district court said, I don't know which of these various pieces of hardware actually corresponds to the transactional operator. But even if it were the general purpose computer, as CAPSEC contends, for them to be able to claim that the general purpose computer is the device that operates as the transactional operator, I think the court's case law is pretty clear that they have to be able to point to an algorithm that is programmed on the general purpose computer, so such that it becomes a special purpose computer for the purposes of transactional operator. Nowhere in any of their briefs, though, have they pointed us to any algorithm that would convert this general purpose computer into a special device that makes it the transactional operator. Certainly not done in any of their briefs, and they can't, but now try to identify any kind of algorithm.
Yeah, they're not relying on 112.6 anyway, right?
Well, they're not, Your Honor, but if they're not relying on 112.6, it's hard for us to see how they can point to the general purpose computer, because the analysis that they've given is to say, we're going to look at the function that is performed that the transactional operator performs. We're going to look to see where that function is in the specification, and then back out and see what structure corresponds to that function.
Giving them the benefit of the doubt, I think they're trying to say that in the claim you see transactional operator, and in light of columns 9 and 10 in the specification, you should understand that term is referring back to.
But Your Honor, that is in essence a 112.6 argument without calling it a 112.6 argument. They want to get the benefit of getting the 112.6 analysis without paying the price of being limited to that disclosed hardware. And our submission is that it just doesn't work. They can't do a 112.6 analysis, not use the label, and therefore avoid having to pay the price. That's what their analysis is, but yet they've disclaimed relying on precisely that. So we think that's reason enough to reject their contention on transactional operator. I'd be happy to answer my questions. Thank you.
I think NCR has, in terms of the ascertaining an apparent signature, confused the issue of what standard a bank may use to decide whether there's a signature on a check to whether the claim is clear as to whether a bank would infringe the claim by trying to detect the presence of a signature on a check. There's no question that regardless of what standard a bank uses for finding a signature, whether it requires characters or just a line or two, the fact is, as long as that bank has configured its ATM to look for a signature, it infringes the claim. That is definite. There's no question that one of ordinary skill would be able to determine whether the bank is taking the image of the check, is looking at the signature field, is looking for content, and makes a determination as to whether a signature is present. That seems to me to be completely objective, and there shouldn't be an issue regarding whether that ascertaining an apparent signature is in fact definite. We note that in the claim construction process, the district court looked at the same intrinsic evidence that we refer to in our appeal and actually provided a construction of this claim term. The district court said that ascertaining an apparent signature is to discover the presence of a person's cursive signature in the signature field. Now, we disagree with the cursive part because we believe a signature, and we believe the evidence is that, and in fact, the district court agreed in its opinion that signatures can be cursive or not. But this indicated that the court was able to look to the intrinsic record to provide a construction at the time. And we think that while it doesn't It's not exactly the same as the construction that we had proposed. It is acceptable, notwithstanding, assuming that we could excise the cursive portion.
But to appreciate that that's our case law doesn't require. I mean, your argument can't be that because a district court in connection with the Markman has hesitation but comes up with some construction that he's precluded later on from them calling it indefinite.
Yes, Your Honor. We don't say that simply because the court construed the claim that, therefore, it is not indefinite. We are saying, however, that this construction is on its face definite. It leaves no question as to what ascertaining an apparent signature is. And so it appears that if the court is able to look at the intrinsic record and the court is able to provide a clear and definite construction of the term, then that would seem to go a long way to show that this is, in fact, a definite term.
Okay. Thank you
very much.
We thank both sides in this case.